Welcome to Farina. This Farina self-drive trail CD has been developed by the Farina Restoration Group Incorporated to help travellers gain an overview of Farina, its past history, and its more recent history as a result of the endeavours of the group. The group's aim is to stabilise the existing buildings so that they don't deteriorate further and to restore the history for travellers to read about and see. The CD hopes to give travellers who don't have a lot of time to explore Farina a quick, low-key and relaxed insight into Farina and the group. Before starting on the self-drive tour, we invite you to listen to a brief history of the town. This history is made up of excerpts from the well-researched book Farina from Gibbers to Ghost Town, which was written by the late Rob Alston. He was one of the three members who founded the Farina Restoration Group in 2008. The book provides an in-depth coverage of the early travellers, the townspeople, the railways, and the town's development and demise. We highly recommend the book to you. Farina was originally known as Government Gums and was a railway town. Its beginnings were as a result of pastoralists and miners in the northern Flinders agitating for a railway line to transport wool and copper to Port Augusta. Favourable seasons in the early 1870s gave credence to the idea that rain would follow the plough, and in 1870 a route between Government Gums and Port Augusta was surveyed. The Railway Act was not passed until 1876, and by 1882 the narrow gauge line had reached Government Gums. That town was now known as Farina, which is the Latin word for flour. The lease of Government Gums was held by A.M. Woolridge, who in 1876 sent Francis and William Humphreys and their small daughter Sarah to take charge of the wells of water springs first found in 1859 by John McDougall Stewart. Government Gums had been surveyed in 1876, and the town's geometric pattern was formulated on that of Adelaide, without regard for local conditions. In 1882, the town had become the railhead and the centre of a network of trade to the inland. It was the main base for camel drivers, who provided goods to stations in the outback. By 1894, the population had grown to around 300. This, however, was short-lived, because when the railway line reached Maree, businesses followed, which diminished Farina's significance, and by 1901, the population had dropped to 133. The railway line was Farina's link with civilization, but trains rarely ran to timetable, and there were frequent derailments. During World War I, troop trains were given precedent over civilian trains, and dust storms and mobile dunes caused havoc with the lines, which created even more unreliability. During World War II, up to four trains a day passed through Farina. In the 1950s, due to the frequent flooding of the narrow gauge line and the need to transport coal from Lee Creek, agitation began for a new standard gauge line to Central Australia. This standard gauge line reached Farina and Maree in 1957. With less need for rail crews, families were transferred from Farina to other rail locations, which affected the viability of the town. The school closed in 1957, the post office in 1960, and the store in 1967. In 1980, the standard gauge line was moved further west of Lake Torrens, and as such, the line to Maree became redundant, and the Farina rail workings came into disuse. Okay, let's start the tour, but don't start your motor just yet. Our first point of interest is the Underground Bakery, which is in the Patterson House area. The Patterson House, which is in front of you, had two chimneys. The Pattersons moved to Farina around 1920 and lived in a house next to the Intercontinental Hotel before moving to the current site. As well as running the Farina station, Gordy Patterson ran a meat and chaff store. Meat was slaughtered from station stock, pieces cut off the bullock's hock, rubbed with salt and placed in a bag and stored in the old underground bakery. Besides Patterson's is the underground bakery. We're not sure when it was first built, but believe that it was in the early 20th century. In 2010, the group restored the bakery and baked bread there for the first time in around 100 years. Bakers line up to volunteer to experience baking in the Scotch oven, which is a rare commodity these days. Over recent years, its popularity with travellers has grown to the extent that the group has bought a caravan to support its fundraising efforts to continue the group's work. Please go inside the bakery for a look around and some photos. The Transcontinental Hotel is behind you and is a building that's received a lot of attention from the group with the need to repoint the rockwork on a regular basis. Due to the climate, moisture is drawn from the ground and chemicals in the moisture affect the mortar, which deteriorates and the rocks become loose. If we lose the rocks, we lose the building. This also applies to other buildings throughout the town. The harsh weather of heat, wind and rain have also affected the buildings which no longer have roofs to protect them. When the hotel closed around August 1918, it was converted into a hospital and later a guest house. The last people to live in the guest house were the Italian rail worker Sammy Viana and his family. Two of his sons are now Farina Group volunteers. It's now time to drive through what could be considered an outdoor museum. By turning left at the first corner into Second Street, you come to the rock corner wall of what was the second police station. Continuing on, you'll see what looks like sleepers planted in the ground, which is called Angel's Rest. This was rumoured to be the house of ill repute, but in fact was the temperance house of Miss Celia Morris, who was a devout Roman Catholic. Interestingly, she also had a shack down by the creek at the same time, which was known as the Devil's Retreat. Continuing on, you'll see the doorway to what was the Church of England. In 1911, John Flynn, who toured the outback in a buckboard hauled by two horses, preached at the Farina Church of England. When operational, attendances were small, and in 1919, Reverend Kane travelled from Adelaide and preached to a congregation of 12. It was sold in 1967, with the corrugated iron sold locally. The font was taken to Carrollton, and when its church was sold, the font was relocated to Port Pirie. The wooden altar is in the Lee Creek family church. A little further on, and you'll come to the rubble of a house with a unique memorial. It's a square steel water tank, with its side painted with the names of the seven daughters of Nat and Lucy Finn. Nat was a rouseabout and general labour, who also trained camels and used them to patrol the dog fence between Lake Torrens and Broken Hill. In 1949, his daughter Dolly, with her husband and son Bill, who has been a group volunteer, demolished the house and salvaged the wood and iron to build a shed at their corn home. As an aside, as you drive around, you'll see more of the water tanks. The camels must have been amazing animals to have been able to carry two of these full of water at any one time. There's a photo at the end of the tour which will confirm this fact. After crossing the road to the station homestead, you'll see the Moffat House on your left. The buildings of Farina cannot be described as grand nor imposing, rather in the tradition of the Australian inland. They are tatty and with a philosophy to make do. People used whatever was available and improvised to provide shelter. Moffat's was an example of this, with stone, timber and iron sheets. Backyards were defined by ragged fences of wire, wood or corrugated iron, and occasionally dry stone walls, against which sand drifts would accumulate. Front fences were either pickets, or as is the case with the Moffats, half-size iron sheets. 3 years ago, the front wall of this house fell over, but thankfully one of our stonemasons took a close-up photo of it the year before and was able to rebuild it to its condition prior to the falling. Much work has been done in cleaning up this house and stabilising the walls. Inside, there are original floorboards, the front fireplace can be seen, and the original kitchen pantry still exists. Before you turn left into the main street and continue on, you'll see mounds of rocks to your right, which were once Bell's store. The original store was owned by J.W. Manfield in 1882 and was taken over by Winifred Budge's father in 1916, who had married Manfield's daughter. Jack Bell worked at the store as a bookkeeper and, after spending some time in Darwin, returned to Farina and bought the store with his brother Jack. In the 1930s, the store was not only the centre of town, but also served the hinterland stations. The store was still operating up to 1967. A more detailed story of the Bells and their store is an interesting read in Rob Alston's book. Once turning left, you'll see the restored post office on your right. Little of the history of the post office is known other than from stories handed down over time. Arnold Dawson was the postmaster in 1928 and had communication interference from flocks of galahs, causing wires to touch each other. When Dawson frightened them off, the bouncing wires would twist together and further upset the signals. He's quoted as saying that the only way to get the wires unsnagged was by tossing smooth stones at the point of the twisting, and this took some time and a lucky shot. Each day he would display a lit kerosene candle in a lantern in the front office of the post office to signal that the mail had been sorted. The Afghans were good customers, but Dawson's work was increased because he would write all of their letters and telegrams. When Muriel Chapman took over the post office in 1941, one of her duties was to take the mail to the train. She did this three times a week at precisely 2:10 a.m. However, sometimes she was still waiting for the train at 7 a.m. Eventually, the mail was deposited in a locked box at 6 p.m., making life easier for Muriel. Farina in Dawson's time had very limited services. Although there was a nurse at the hospital, the gravely ill were ferried to Hawker or Port Augusta. Teeth were extracted at the hotel veranda by any travelling dentist, whether he was sober or not.